This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
The NFL season is right around the corner. Seahawks get underway with training camp starting on Wednesday. Cannot wait for the season to get started. And we get a little preview of division rival, the Arizona Cardinals, now with their sideline reporter, Paul Calvisi, joining us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Hello, Paul.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Doing great. Getting excited for the season, fired up for that, and reading headlines about everybody, and it seems that the headline connected to the Cardinals, not a great one today. Chandler Jones, not happy, wants out. What do you think? Is this posturing? Are they going to get something worked out with him, or is he going to be elsewhere when the season starts?
Yeah, not a shock. He didn't show up to mandatory minicamp. Although he did go to the media day event the Cardinals had internally, which isn't open to the media. It's more for internal, filming and preseason. And he was in a great mood, when he showed up. So make of that what you will. Obviously, it's his only leverage right now in terms of trying to generate a new contract at this point in the process. He had the season-ending biceps tear in week 5 a year ago, and we didn't see him the rest of the year. So he has 1 year left on his deal, over $15 million in base salary. His cap hits about $20 million. And we'll find out tomorrow. The Cardinals' run test is tomorrow. First actual practice is Wednesday. Will Chandler Jones be there? As we know, it's a $50,000 daily fine, and teams are no longer able to rescind those fines, although you can work them into a future contract and count for it accordingly. But I would be surprised if he's not there tomorrow, despite the fact that, the news came out over the weekend. Here's a question, guys. Did he ask for a trade early in the offseason, or was it more recently? And that was not specified in the report, so it's hard to know exactly where Chandler is at right here, right now, with his mindset.
Well, I think the question is Paul Calvisi and Ron Wolfley going to be flying up to Seattle and going on the road and doing the games on the road? Do you know yet, Paul?
As of right now, we will be on the road.
Okay.
A year ago, Ron Wolfley and Dave Pasch, they actually were at the stadium, and yours truly, I was the one member of the team who actually went on the road. And we're one of the few teams to actually travel anyone. And even though I couldn't get down on the sideline in the visiting venues, I would still have to be up in the visiting radio booth. Yeah. It was surreal, guys. I mean, we went to New York twice, and I could hear the noise, the chatter on the Cardinals sideline better from the visiting radio booth in an empty MetLife Stadium in New York at the mezzanine level than I could being on the sideline 10 feet away from guys on a game day full of fans. It was just crazy, some of the settings. I mean, yeah, we always love coming to Seattle and the crowd noise and so forth. So to be in that stadium on that Thursday night game and have zero fans, it was so unreal in so many ways. So, yeah, looking forward to hopefully having fans and full stadiums again.
Yeah, it was just bizarre. I think the only thing that Rabel and I really liked or really enjoyed about it was that you could hear a lot of the chatter down on the field. We heard somebody complaining to a ref and, that kind of stuff. Yep. But, yeah, so, yeah, getting back to the defense, I mean, you got J.J. Watt there, Chandler Jones. I mean, you look at – and the kid that they drafted, I thought that guy, he was kind of a physical, freak type of guy. It just seems like on defense, you lost some defensive backs, but, you also got Malcolm Butler, who we don't like seeing around here, Paul, because he picked off a certain pass. But, I mean, it seems like they're loaded anyway, talent-wise, as far as like raw talent on your defense.
Yeah, the last time Malcolm Butler played a game at State Farm Stadium, well, you guys know the game. We'll leave it at that.
I know what you're talking about.
21, by the way. Yeah. Patrick Peterson went to the Minnesota Vikings on a one-year, $8 million deal. So Malcolm Butler is the lead corner right now. Nobody really expects him to travel with the other team's number one and to shadow a guy all game long like Pat P did, although they didn't really do that the second half of last season. Byron Murphy is the number two corner, UW guy. After that, it's a huge question mark. The biggest question mark on the defense, Can Robert Alford come back and actually be a viable player? Each of the last 2 years in training camp, he suffered a season-ending injury. They have some two young guys, a fourth-rounder and a sixth-rounder they drafted, both with really good size. In fact, when I saw them during minicamp, guys, these two rookie corners who are both about 6'1", I said, wow, those look like two corners the Seahawks would find in the later stages of the draft. So we're intrigued by that. Cardinals just signed another corner today, veteran Darrell Worley, who was with the Raiders most recently. They signed Darquez Bernard. So they're flooding that position with numbers, and they're going to see who emerges out of camp. The rookie middle linebacker who gets a starting assignment from day one, 16th pick overall, first-round pick, Zaven Collins, you're referring to out of Tulsa. He is a freak. I mean, he's 6'5", 260, and he's your Mike linebacker. Wow. He is a throwback to, you know, the days when those guys were just gigantic. And pairing him next to Isaiah Simmons and the athleticism of the 2020 first-round pick, who didn't get a ton of reps last year, just with a pandemic and no preseason, he never beat out Devondre Campbell for that starting spot. Well, now the two young guys, they're going to live or die with those guys at the two inside linebacker positions.
Hey, let me bring you back to Chandler Jones for a moment, because I feel like he's one of the more underrated pass rushers in the league. We don't hear his name mentioned a lot when you talk about the great pass rushers, and J.J. Watt is a great example. He gets mentioned all the time. You got his brother. You've got so many other names, Aaron Donald, that get mentioned before Chandler Jones. You look at what he's done. He never missed a game in his time with Arizona in the regular season. He played every single game. Never had fewer than 11 sacks. He went 11, 17, 13, 19. And then last year, he only played five games. That was the first year he missed any time. So what does this defense look like without him? You got a taste of it last year. You get J.J. Watt, but, I mean, we don't know what version, you know, how diminished is J.J. Watt. What does this team look like if you don't have Chandler Jones, somebody who's been that productive?
Yeah, the stat is since he came into the league in 2012, no one has more sacks than Chandler Jones. You're absolutely right. I think he has 97 sacks, which leads the NFL, and then J.J. Watt over that span is number two. But they're both in their 30s. Chandler Jones is 31, suffered the biceps tear week five last year. He only had one sack at that point, but he was getting doubled all the time. I mean, like we've never seen before. He was getting so much attention from the opposing pass protection scheme. So now you get someone who Vance Joseph says in J.J. Watt, he's going to put on the opposite side of Chandler Jones. And what is that going to do for an offense's pass pro scheme and the ability to stay honest? Because if you get Chandler Jones one-on-one with someone, odds are he's going to get into the pocket and make some noise. There's no doubt about that. You know, the thing with the Cardinals that was confounding last year is Chandler Jones went down, and they ended up being top five in sacks. They had 48 sacks in the year, which was fourth, and they were fifth overall in sacks per attempt. So Vance Joseph dialed it up, and he got exotic, and they got a lot of production out of Hassan Reddick, who signed with the Carolina Panthers, a former first-rounder whose first 4 years with the Cardinals was a disappointment, to say the least. So we'll see. What exactly is Vance Joseph going to do this time around, the defensive coordinator? You also have Marcus Golden, who they traded for midseason. And Marcus Golden, from week nine through the end of the year, if I saw the stat right, had the best QB pressure rate of anyone in the NFL. So that's what they're hoping for. And then they'll definitely be sending Isaiah Simmons and Buda Baker, the former UW guy, as Vance Joseph likes to do on third and long.
Hey, Paul, what's the sort of talk down there about Kyler Murray? I was impressed last year. I mean, even his rookie year, 64% completion percentage, which is something I think highly of if you're good in that area, 67% last year. But what's the talk down there about when his name comes up? Is this a prove it year? Are people happy? Do they think he needs to improve? Where is he at?
You know, he was asked what he wants to improve in year three, and the first thing he said was leadership, which was intriguing. So, and I think a lot of guys would agree with that. You know, the Cardinals' area where they needed to get better a year ago was just being consistent with the energy, the intensity, the urgency. I mean, they had two games at the end of the year, guys, against two backup quarterbacks, and they win either one of those against the Niners and Rams, and they're into the playoffs. And they lost both. And so Kyler Murray's tried to take some of that onto his shoulders in the offseason. I think the big question for everyone is can he have a similar third year to what you just saw from Baker Mayfield and Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson? And that is to say, go beyond the stats and get your team a playoff win. I think that's really the challenge for Kyler Murray. And now that you got him some more weapons, you know, nobody had a bigger percentage of receiving yards as for a single receiver in the NFL than DeAndre Hopkins a year ago. So now you had A.J. Green. You draft Rondale Moore out of Purdue, the 4-2-9 guy in round two. You hope Christian Kirk, now that they're going to move him exclusively inside as a slot guy, can be what you hoped for 3-4 years ago when you drafted him in round two. You get him a revamped running game with Chase Edmonds, and you sign James Conner as a power back from the Pittsburgh Steelers. You have a little more balanced offense. And then the other thing people are talking about is, will they put him under center a little bit more, and will they go with a little bit more play action? Or now that Cliff Kingsbury has four viable receiving options, will he go 10 personnel more than ever? They led the league last year in that category, going four receivers and one back about 20% of the time.
What is the perception of Kingsbury out there?
You know, he's a likable guy. People are just wondering, can he motivate this team to the next step? When he took over the team, people were realistic. In 2018, coming off the Steve Wilkes year, the one and done head coach of the Arizona Cardinals, they had a historically bad offense. So they made progress each of the last 2 years, 2019, 2020. But there are also other areas. For example, last year the Cardinals led the NFL in penalties. Those areas that have to be cleaned up. So Steve Keim made a point in the offseason of trying to get guys who are also noted leaders, the J.J. Watts, making a trade for Rodney Hudson, the two-time Pro Bowl center who's a commanding presence and a veteran guy, came over from the Raiders. And should really help Kyler Murray in just recognizing what he's seen at the line of scrimmage and being the quarterback of the offensive line. So, you know, I think most people figure if the Cardinals don't get into the playoffs this year, then, yeah, that seat could be a little warm for Cliff Kingsbury, and there might be change. We'll see, unless, of course, it's the defense that ends up being the fail this season, because Kingsbury really concerns him most of the time with the offense only, although he's made a concerted effort to concentrate a little bit more on the other side of the ball so far in the mini camps and off-season activities.
Hey, Paul, we were just talking about the rivalries that develop, and we're talking about the Mariners and the A's right now. It's kind of developing into something, but I think a lot of Seahawks fans up here will agree that when it was Jim Harbaugh and Pete Carroll, the Niners and the Seahawks, that was just such a, you know, you love to hate them, the sports hate. But as far as Arizona goes, that yeah, there was a little bit, I think, when Bruce Arians there where people were talking about it. But as far as fans down there, who is their natural rival down there? Is it the Seahawks, do you think, in this division?
I would say so. Yeah, I would say so, honestly. You know, we like to hate the L.A. teams, but the L.A. teams don't have the same disdain for Phoenix as we do for them.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the Seahawks, and there's that weird dynamic that a year ago the Cardinals finally beat Russell Wilson at home for the first time since his rookie year 2012. He'd won seven in a row in the AZ. Conversely, the Cardinals have won six of their last eight in Seattle.
Right.
So I can tell you this much. The Cardinals players love the Seattle road trip. They love that stadium. They love the us against them. They love John with the 12s. Believe me, I see it every single year. The 12s are all over the Cardinals visiting bench, and the players are giving it back to them. And there's a reason why the Cardinals play well in Seattle, because the fans get them jacked up. And then conversely, there are a lot of Seahawks fans who invade State Farm Stadium.
Right.
And so that used to really torque Bruce Arians and trigger him. He didn't like that at all.
So what are the expectations from you and maybe some of the fans out there in terms of how this division shakes out this year? You know, everybody makes predictions now. We haven't seen anything. Rosters aren't set. So we don't know what the rosters ultimately will look like. But what's your expectation? Who do you see winning the division? Where do the Cardinals fall? If you're gonna rank them 1 through 4, how do you see it shaking out?
You know, I'm not as much a believer in the Niners rebounding. I'm not a big believer in their defense other than Nick Bosa. I'm not sure exactly where the pass rush is coming from. I know Fred Warner is someone they're going to send, and they just paid him. And Fred Warner's an unbelievable linebacker. I love watching him play. I think there's a lot of question marks when we look at the Seahawks' defense. And then what exactly did defenses do against Russell Wilson the second half of last year? Are they going to be able to adjust to the adjustment, which is a similar challenge for the Cardinals offense, guys? If you remember, Cardinals went into Seattle for that Thursday night game, and they were 6-3 at that point, including a Sunday night win against the Seahawks in overtime at home. And then early in that game, Kyler Murray got hurt. He hurt his shoulder.
Yeah.
He only ran for 15 yards in that game, and they were never the same. 5 of the last 7 games down the stretch. And teams went with a too high safety look. They flooded the underneath with zone coverages. They forced Kyler to hold the ball a little bit longer. And I'll be darned, if I didn't see a John Clayton column on that same topic pertaining to Russell Wilson and the Seahawks and whether they can beat that defensive approach. So that is a challenge for the Cardinals on offense. And with that in mind, I see the Rams still as a team to beat, even though they lost Cam Akers. And with Matthew Stafford in there, and after that, I think it's going to be a dogfight. And you guys know, if you win the NFC West, you've got a good shot at the NFC Championship. That's how fierce the division is, top to bottom.
Yep. Paul, we really appreciate you taking the time. It's always good to catch up with you, and I'm sure we'll talk during the season. Thanks so much.
Yep, look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Paul.
There you go. Paul Calvisi, Cardinals sideline reporter and host on Arizona Sports 98.7 FM out there with the Cardinals, and it's interesting to hear that they look at the Seahawks as their rival. I don't know how many fans out here look at the Cardinals. I think they have a lot more heat directed at the 49ers and Rams. I would put the Cardinals last if we were ranking the three in terms of sports hate among Seahawks fans.
Yeah.
I think the Cardinals would definitely be last.
Well, I was pretty sure he was going to answer the Seahawks, and the reason why is, like he said, and having gone down there a few times, you see it's just flooded with Seahawks jerseys.
Right.
I mean, they're everywhere. Actually, I saw a fight down there one time because remember the kickoff team? They used to, they run through the end zone and then they go and high-five all the fans here at home. Well, they do the same thing on the road, except they will, find whatever Seahawk fans. And so there was a couple Seahawk fans that came running down the stairs to try to do that. And then the Arizona fans started pushing them, and all of a sudden there was this whole thing that broke out. And so, yeah, I think they hate that part because they don't like that the Seahawk fans are so prominent whenever
they travel
a home game. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and it seems like it's that way everywhere we go. I mean, the one place I remember thinking – wow, I thought Pittsburgh and Cleveland were like places that you did not see a lot of. I mean, there was lots of loyalty there in both those places. But as far as, on the road, you see a lot in L.A. I mean, I just don't think you see that many opposing fans here in Seattle. So
you're going to see some no matter where you go. But I think the Seahawks ticket season ticket holders are pretty passionate about keeping their tickets or selling them or giving them to other Seahawks fans. Yeah, you're right. You do see opposing fans, but not in mass, not the way you do with Seahawks fans elsewhere. They've got a knack. I don't know if – I'm not sure what the ticket sales are like in these other places, if it's like it is here where there's a waiting list for years or if it's pretty easy to get somebody to sell you the tickets. But, boy, they sure find their way into those games.
Well, I think it's funny. I mean, him being the sideline reporter, that he's noticed that the fans give it to the players and the players give it back. And he's right. Unfortunately, they've had a lot of success up here. But we've had success down there. So it's kind of a weird phenomenon. They sort of swap, as far as success on the road. But, yeah, it's I don't know. I just never thought of the Seahawks fans as being, like, nasty or mean or anything like that. I just think that they let guys hear about it a little bit. I feel like it's not like – I used to go on the road, like, Oakland, and even with the Coliseum, it was just the Raider fans maybe. But just Kansas City fans, couldn't stand them. And I got to say Denver, and I always tell you that, they turn on you there. But just a lot of very non-creative – just, swearing and screaming and yelling.
Non-creative, just random swear words.
I mean, you like the stuff that's like, remember the heckler in Toronto when George Springer was up to bat?
Yeah,
like, You're still a cheater.
You know,
those kinds of things are kind of funny. But some of them are just, kind of stupid.
Just random curse words.
Yeah. I mean, be clever about it. It's like you say with mean texts, Bob. You always say, just be creative, be clever. And yeah, sometimes the fans not the best at that. But I think the Seahawk fans are a little more sophisticated.
Yeah, a little more
creativity.
Does
that creativity. Sound like I'm looking down my nose at the rest of
a little
the
bit,
NFL?
Yeah. I'm sure we'll get a text right. soon saying, Dave, quit being so elitist.
Yeah. I'm not saying talk. It that way. I'm just saying, you know, they're creative. They come up with good stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's just in him saying that yeah, it's the Seahawks for them down there. And it makes sense based on everything you said and Russell and the team's success down there. It feels like back when you were playing when it was, you know, the Seahawks. I don't know that any other team in the division considered them a rival. We as Seahawks fans looked at Denver and were like, oh, I hate John Elway, I hate the Broncos, or I hate the Raiders. I don't think the Raiders or the Broncos looked at the Seahawks as their rival.
It was a one-way deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so to me it was the Raiders. I felt like the Raider haters would show up and they'd have the T-shirts and everything like that, much more than Denver. But, yeah, I mean, I would say that probably the Rams and San Francisco fans feel like it's Seattle.
I would think so, yeah. Without question. All right. Our thanks to Paul Calvisi for spending some time with us. I love this text, Dave. This tells me this person hasn't been listening.
Okay.
Which is fine. You can't listen all day.
Why?
I
did he
it.
Pick a mohawk over a mullet?
No. 253 says, hi, I love you guys. It's a good start. Then in capital letters. But do you ever have Mariners segments? The Astros are in town. If you want to talk rivals, just saying.
Gosh.
We opened the show with Mariners. We've been hitting Mariners throughout the show. And, in fact, we got a Mariners segment coming up next. So if you're just joining us, 253, we're going to talk to Daniel Kramer, who writes for MLB.com, covers the Mariners, talking about some of these rumored trades that could be heating up. We're going to get into all of that coming up next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Hey, look at this, Dave. We're finally doing a Mariners segment.
Yeesh. Can't do one football segment?
Oh, man. It's, you know what? That just tells you how passionate people are right now. People are fired up about this team. There's a lot of intensity and a lot of excitement about the way they've been playing, a game and a half out of the wild card. And here to talk more Mariner baseball with us, does a great job covering the team for MLB.com. He joins us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Daniel Kramer is here. Daniel, how are you, man?
Hey, boys. How we doing? Thanks for having me back.
It's good to talk to you. And it's... before we get into any specifics, is this weekend just the intensity of the crowd, the volume, you see them hanging on the edge of their seats with everything that's going on, one run win, seeing the excitement of the players. This is a different vibe. There's just a different intensity to what's going on with this team right now. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, this is my third season in Seattle. I mean, last year there were no fans, obviously, and then 2019 was a huge step back. But this past weekend, it was the loudest I've heard the crowd, the most on edge of the seat that I've heard the crowd, just, you know, most into the game that I've seen the crowd. And, you know, I've asked some of the players and the coaches and, you know, even Scott Service, you know, at this point in the season, you know, you're in it. The deadline is this Friday. I mean, does it feel more intense? And, you know, not a lot of the guys are holding back and saying that, yeah, it really does. And so you got Houston coming in here for three games, a first place team. I think the competitive barometer and litmus test, you know, it's about as high as it's ever been, and coming off a big weekend against Oakland, should be an exciting three-game set.
Well, what do you think, Daniel? Kind of a broad question here, but what do you think they're thinking as they race towards this deadline that's coming up, as you said, on Friday? Are they buyers? If so, where do you think, what are the positions you think that need to be addressed?
Well, I think the way they've played has kind of eliminated any possibility of them selling at this point. I mean, it would almost be a disrespect to the clubhouse and the fan base at this point because how close you are into the hunt. You know, a couple weeks ago, I would have said, hey, if you're four or five games out, you can get some really good prospects back, maybe. But, you know, they feel in it, and the players feel that they've done, you know, their part. And, you know, even Kyle Seager was saying that after the game yesterday, you know, that we would like to think that they would add at this point. So, at this point, you know, based on some of the conversations I've had on behind the scenes, they are looking. The big areas of need are pretty obvious. They need a right-handed bat. They've gotten some of the lowest production in the league at second base. And like any other team in the majors, they could really use a starting pitcher, maybe more than just one. But the problem with that is there's just such a lack of depth out there right now in the starting rotation market. I mean, you don't even really know how many back of the rotation end arms are even available at this point. You know, you don't have like a headliner such as you, Darvish, or, you know, Garrett Cole or somebody out there that's available. It's kind of interesting. There's just a dearth of starters who are available. But, you know, second base is one that really sticks out. I mean, they've had a need there since going back to last winter when they were in the market for Tommy La Stella and Colton Wong and ultimately came up short. So we'll see if they make a move here in the coming days to bolster that position.
How much stock do you put in the Whit Merrifield rumors that they're interested? He would address two of those needs that Jerry's brought up, the right-handed hitting, the second baseman. He can play outfield as well. He's 32 years old, so he's not a young guy. He's not a power guy, but he does get on base. He steals. I mean, he's leading the league in stolen bases, so you've got some really intriguing aspects to his game. Does he fill that need in your mind, or do you see them going after somebody younger? What are your thoughts with him?
I would definitely put stock into that intrigue from the Mariners front office. He's almost like a Jerry DePoto, Scott Service type player. You know, he steals a ton of bases. He makes a ton of contact. He doesn't strike out very often, and he plays all over the field. And even more so, he's got a really affordable contract, and he's under club control for the next 2 years if you include the 2023 option. So, I mean, there's a lot to like about what he brings to the table. Not so much concerned about the age, him being 32. If anything, you bring in another veteran in here for a very young nucleus that you already have established and possibly inject him at or near the top of the lineup if they're able to make something happen. But I think there's a lot to like about what he brings to the table. The question is, and there's definitely interest on the Mariners' end of things, but the question is, you know, what's it going to cost to get him? He's kind of the face of the Kansas City franchise right now, who are not as good as they maybe had hoped to be, but they have some prospects coming up in the coming years. And, you know, Witt is under contract, and you have an owner there who really likes him. So it could be tough to get a deal done. I mean, even if the Royals general manager, Dayton Moore, wants to sell him and has a great offer, whether it's from Seattle or elsewhere, it could be a tough sell among ownership, which, you know, could throw more leverage back into the, you know, the Royals' favor with any team that they're talking to. So it'll be interesting. I think he is going to cost quite a bit for all the reasons that I just said. But, you know, he's definitely out there, and you know, the Mariners have the pieces to make it done if they are so inclined.
Well, and you just hit on what I was going to ask you, and that was the price. We've talked about, Dave and I were talking earlier about, you know, you're going to give up somebody that we've talked a lot about, whether it's, you know, somebody deep in the minor league system, somebody on the major league roster. You're going to give up something to get something. Do you use the Frazier deal as any sort of barometer? Now, he's a few years younger. He's 29. He'll be 30 in December. But there are three prospects we're giving up for Adam Frazier. So do you use that as sort of a barometer, or do you feel like he's worth more because he's younger? How do you view those two?
I definitely think you look at that as a barometer for sure, and I definitely think the Royals are as well. And, you know, like I just said about Kansas City really coveting him and possibly wanting to keep on to him, you know, the Pirates were going to get rid of Frazier regardless. So, yeah, I do think it's going to cost two or three prospects, probably three at the very least, and you know, you're probably going to be parting ways with some of the names that you have heard about over the past few years as the Mariners have accumulated all this talent. You got to think that they're probably going to want one of those top three pitchers, whether it's Kirby, Hancock, or Brandon Williamson. I mean, if you're the Royals, they're definitely going to do their due diligence and ask for Noel V. Marte. But, you know, maybe if you throw in one of those pitchers and maybe a Caden Polkovich or a Zach DeLoach, you know, maybe that's what gets it done. But, you know, it takes two to tango, and you do have to pay if you want to, you know, bring in a game-changing type talent like Whit Merrifield. So, it'll cost something for sure. You know, one point Scott Service made today when we talked to him on his pregame call was that, you know, it's nice to be in this position that we have just about as much prospect capital in the majors as any team. You know, we could hypothetically be in on any player and have a seat at the table. So the Mariners definitely have the chips to work with. It's just a matter of, you know, which ones they're willing to part with. And, you know, Jerry DePoto, he's an aggressive trader for sure. But he also is a guy that will walk away from the table if he doesn't feel like the price is fair. So a lot in play for sure.
Hey, Daniel, real quick, we're kind of up against the break, but just a little Kelnick report. I thought it was important that, you know, he laid off those two pitches, got on base, ends up scoring. He got a hit yesterday. Do you think he's turning around? What have you seen from him since he's been called back up?
I saw him on the field today, and I laughed at him about the powder that he got splattered in his face after scoring the game winner. And he just broke out into a big grin. And I think that was my biggest takeaway with talking with Jared today. Is he seems to be smiling again. You know, it's little things like that are big. You know, it's small victories in the grand scheme of things with him, just because he's, you know, he's had some tough luck here and he's had some tough times. But, you know, the quality of the bat seemed to be improving again. I think when I was on with you guys a couple weeks ago, when he was still back in the minors, we talked about he was just getting jammed against lefties so much in his first stint in the show. And it seems like that's been a case again, you know, here against some really tough lefties and against Oakland. I'm sure that he's really excited to be facing three Astros right-handers in a row. So that's, you know, a story within the game to watch, is to see how he kind of attacks those starting pitchers and, you know, welcomes that challenge and, you know, maybe gets into some more favorable matchups. But yeah, I think small victories with Jared Kelnick and obviously today he was obviously smiling. So that was something that stood out to me.
Daniel Kramer of MLB.com has been our guest here talking Mariner baseball. Daniel, thanks so much, man. Always good to talk to you, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
All right, appreciate it, guys. Call me anytime.
There you go. Good stuff from Daniel Kramer. Does a great job covering the team. By the way, the Mariners taking on the Astros tonight, and the T-Mobile Park roof will be open. I'm undefeated in this day.
100%.
It's uncanny, my ability to predict the roof when it's 80 degrees outside. That's the Mariners Roof Report, covered by Acton's Quality Roofing. All right, it's the final days of our 20 Best Seahawks countdown. We get into single digits now. Our top 10 begins next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our top 20 Seahawks countdown continues. In case you missed this early in the show, we unveiled our next five. We did this last year. It's, again, often imitated, never duplicated, Dave, the top 20 countdown.
Yeah, but how'd we do last year? I mean, there was a couple. We were pretty close on a lot of the players.
You and I had essentially the same group of players for the most part in different spots, sometimes by one spot. You know, you had one higher than I did, or I had one higher than you. But we're getting into an area where the top 10 becomes kind of obvious, I guess. It's just a matter of where you place them. So looking at last year, now we're going 10 to 6. Or 11 to 6, excuse me. So we both had Jaron Reed at number 11 last year. You had Lockett at 10, KJ at 9, Diggs at 8, Dwayne Brown at 7, and DK Metcalf at 6.
Right.
We both had Reed at 11. I had Disley at 10, DK at 9, Diggs at 8, like you did, KJ at 7, Chris Carson at 6. So
yeah.
That's what we looked like last year.
Right. Yeah, and so, yeah, I think you also got to take some chances here. I mean, there's going to be breakout players that, you know, have. And I would say, you know, I thought we both did really well with Quandre Diggs. I mean, that's ranking him pretty high at number 8, and he had a Pro Bowl year.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Such a great pickup. I love that pickup so much.
Yeah, same. I mean, just not for very much. And being able to identify a guy like that that is just going to fit into your system, just awesome. So, and he's one of those guys that's around the ball a lot. So, and that's kind of makes up for, you know, you got Adams, who's a different kind of player, maybe not such a ball hawk, but more of a just explosive player. But yeah, so I think, you know, and then a lot of it is injuries. But, you know, I thought really highly of Will Disley last year. I still do. I still think very highly of him, but, you know, not quite as much. I just think this year it's going to be different because I think they're going to get the tight ends more involved.
I certainly hope so, man. They couldn't be less involved than they were last year. And again, I don't know whose fault that was, combo of the scheme versus them, production. Olsen wasn't what we thought he'd be and, you know, what have you. I don't know. But they just, as a group, were not very present last year. But so give us your 10 through 6.
10 through 6. I got Will Disley. I bumped him back a little bit. So, yeah, last year, like I said, I had him as the number 5 player. I think he's a great all-around tight end. I mean, he's a great blocker, obviously, but he's got great hands, really makes good plays. It's a health thing with him. And then how about throwing the ball? throwing the ball. So, you know, that I think will happen. This is one I don't want everybody to freak out over, okay? I put Bobby Wagner at number nine.
What?
Yeah, I think Bobby is a Hall of Famer. He is the kind of player that I wanted to be, Bob. Like, he gets lots of interceptions, and he's around the ball. You know, I was more of
$18 million a year.
Well, that part too. Although I would have given like 17 of it to you because I don't think you should have that much money.
You don't want to get weird.
Yeah, I don't want to get weird. So, but yeah, I just think maybe they use him a little bit differently this year. He played in 100% of the snaps that weren't the Jet game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the only break he got. So, I mean, I think they're going to have to kind of take him off the field, manage him, all that kind of stuff, and then, you know, let him do what he does. I mean, the game he had against San Francisco was fantastic. So, anyway, then I go Dwayne Brown at number 8, Jordan Brooks at number 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just because I think he's going to be on the field all the time. And then I go to Quandre Diggs at number 6, which, you know, we bumped him up a couple of spots there. Who you got?
My number 10 is Damian Lewis. I thought he had such a tremendous rookie year. He was everything you hoped he would be and more after all the problems they had on the O-line. Played center, played guard. He's just a guy that played really, really well and certainly not like a rookie. Jordan Brooks, number 9 for me. Just want to see him on the field more, which I agree with you. I think we'll see him a ton more on the field. So he's certainly top 10 in my book. Number 8, Chris Carson. The only thing knocking him back is availability. When he's healthy, he's as good as it gets in this league. He is dominant. He is physical. He is a load and a hard to bring down. So I've got him at 8. Quandre Diggs at number 7. We just talked about him. Absolutely love that pick. For a 5th-round pick, you got yourself a Pro Bowler. He's fantastic. And then Tyler Lockett, as consistent as it gets. Coming off a career year last year, 100 receptions. He's that security blanket that Russell had with Doug Baldwin, and he's found it once again with Tyler Lockett. When the play breaks down, he's the guy. He's the guy that just seems to be open. We don't know how he doesn't know how he does it. We asked him.
Yeah.
He just finds that guy. He finds that separation of a couple yards, and Russell seems to find him.
Well, and I remember you talking to him. We were talking to him last year, and you asked him about, you know, you've never been that guy that points at the back of his jersey or his nameplate or anything. And he's like, I'm fine with that. I'm comfortable with that. Because I feel like maybe if he did a little bit more of that, maybe people around the NFL would have more respect for him. But when you look at the catches that he makes, they're as good as any, you know. And maybe DeAndre Hopkins is maybe a better route runner. I don't know. But, I mean, as far as hands go, and it's not like he has these huge hands or anything. I mean, he's not a very big guy. But the one that he caught off of his wrist or his forearm that we talked about, he told us it hurt.
Well, the one we see replays of, was it 2 seasons ago, or the corner of the end zone the probability was minuscule. I mean, it had to be the perfect throw, and there was no room for his feet to go any further toward the end line. And he just is leaning with his toes on the back of the end zone and makes that. I mean, that was beyond spectacular.
How do you stretch that far out with your arms and then, you know, stretch that far back with your
body control?
It's like the
ridiculous
toenails.
In the throw, not to take anything from Russell, that was a brilliant throw, but catch, that just shows the connection those two have. And when Tyler's gotten into that mode like Doug, where if he doesn't catch a ball that hits his hands, you're kind of like, well, that was weird. How did that happen?
Weird. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, we'll see where I have Lockett tomorrow.
Yeah, well, you obviously have him higher than I do because there's no way you left that man off your list.
Well, I think we take him a little bit for granted. So
yeah, and by the way, 509 says, my number 10 is Cody Barton. I got your back, Dave.
All right, there we go. I hope you're right, man. Hope you're right.
All right, that does it for us. I want to thank our guests today, John Clayton, Paul Calvisi, and Daniel Kramer for joining us on the show. If you missed any of it, you missed a whole bunch. So head to the podcast page at 710sports.com. Click that podcast tab, scroll down to our picture, and click on that. Everything you missed is waiting there for you each and every single day. You got the Mariners pregame show coming up next. Game 1 of their series with the hated, cheating Houston Astros. We'll talk about it tomorrow right here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.